Interestingly, this is the kind of education that a father habitually gives his daughter. Women brought up by a man escape many of the defects of femininity. But customs oppose treating girls exactly like boys. I knew a village where girls of 3 and 4 years old were persecuted because their father made them wear trousers. Are they girls or boys? And other children tried to find out. The result was their pleading to wear dresses. Unless she leads a very solitary life, even if parents allow her to have boyish manners, the girl's companions, her friends, and her teachers will be shocked. There will always be aunts, grandmothers, and girl cousins to counterbalance the father's influence. Normally, his role regarding his daughters is secondary. One of the woman's curses, as Michelet has justly pointed out, is that in her childhood, she is left in the hands of women. The boy is also brought up by his mother in the beginning, but she respects his maleness, and he escapes from her relatively quickly, whereas the mother wants to integrate the girl into the feminine world. Note, there are, of course, many exceptions, but the mother's role in bringing up a boy cannot be studied here. We will hear later how complex the relation is between the mother and the daughter. For the mother, the daughter is both her double and an other. The mother cherishes her and at the same time is hostile to her. She imposes her own destiny on her child. It is a way to proudly claim her own femininity and also to take revenge on it. The same process is found with pederasts, gamblers, drug addicts, and all those who are flattered to belong to a certain community and are also humiliated by it. They try through ardent proselytism to win over converts. Thus, women given the care of a little girl are bent on transforming her into women like themselves, with zeal and arrogance mixed with resentment. And even a generous mother who sincerely wants the best for her child will, as a rule, think it wiser to make a true woman of her, as that is the way she will be best accepted by society. So she is given other little girls as friends. She is entrusted to female teachers. She lives among matrons as in the days of the Geneseum. Books and games are chosen for her that introduce her to her destiny. Her ears are filled with the treasures of feminine wisdom. Feminine virtues are presented to her. She is taught cooking, sewing, and housework, as well as how to dress, how to take care of her personal appearance, charm, and modesty. She is dressed in uncomfortable and fancy clothes that she has to take care of. Her hair is done in complicated styles. Posture is imposed on her. Stand up straight, don't walk like a duck. To be graceful, she has to repress spontaneous movements. She is told not to look like a tomboy. Strenuous exercise is banned. She is forbidden to fight. In short, she is committed to becoming, like her elders, a servant and an idol. Today, thanks to feminism's breakthroughs, it is becoming more and more normal to encourage her to pursue her education, to devote herself to sports. But she is more easily excused for not succeeding. Success is made more difficult for her as another kind of accomplishment is demanded of her. She must at least also be a woman. She must not lose her femininity. In her early years, she resigns herself to this lot without much difficulty. The child inhabits the level of play and dream. He plays at being, he plays at doing. Doing and being are not clearly distinguishable when it is a question of imaginary accomplishments. The little girl can compensate for boy's superiority of the moment by those promises inherent in her woman's destiny, which she already achieves in her play. Because she still only knows her childhood universe, her mother seems endowed with more authority than her father. She imagines the world as a sort of matriarchy. She imitates her mother. She identifies with her. Often, she even inverses the roles. "When I am big and you are little," she often says. The doll is not only her double, it is also her child. Functions that are not mutually exclusive insofar as the real child is also an alter ego for the mother. When she scolds, punishes, and then consoles her doll, she is defending herself against her mother, and she assumes a mother's dignity. She sums up both elements of the couple as she entrusts herself to her doll, educates her, asserts her sovereign authority over her, and sometimes even tears off her arms, beats her, tortures her. That is to say, through her, she accomplishes the experience of subjective affirmation and alienation. Often the mother is associated with this imaginary life. In playing with the doll and the mother, the child plays both the father and the mother, a couple where the man is excluded. No maternal instinct, innate and mysterious, lies therein either. The little girl observes that child care falls to the mother. That is what she is taught. Stories told, books read, all her little experience confirms it. She is encouraged to feel delight for these future riches. She is given dolls, so she will already feel the tangible aspect of those riches. Her vocation is determined imperiously. Because her lot seems to be the child, and also because she is more interested in her insides than the boy, the little girl is particularly curious about the mystery of procreation. She quickly ceases to believe that babies are born in cabbages or delivered by the stork, especially in cases where the mother gives her brothers or sisters. She soon learns that babies are formed in their mother's body. Besides, parents today make less of a mystery of it than before. She is generally more amazed than frightened because the phenomenon seems like magic to her. She does not yet grasp all of the physiological implications. First of all, she is unaware of the father's role and supposes that the woman gets pregnant by eating certain foods, a legendary theme. Queens in fairy tales give birth to a little girl or a handsome boy after eating this fruit, that fish, and one that later leads some women to link the idea of gestation and the digestive system. Together, these problems and these discoveries absorb a great part of the little girl's interests and feed her imagination. I will cite a typical example from Jung, which bears remarkable analogies with that of little Hans, analyzed by Freud around the same time. Note, Jung, Psychic Conflicts of a Child. When Anna was about 3 years old, she began to question her parents about where babies come from. Anna had heard that children are little angels. She first seemed to think that when people die, they go to heaven and are reincarnated as babies. At age 4, she had a little brother. She hadn't seemed to notice her mother's pregnancy, but when she saw her the day after the birth, she looked at her with something like a mixture of embarrassment and suspicion, and finally asked her, "Aren't you going to die now?" She was sent to her grandmother's for some time. When she came back, a nurse had arrived and was installed near the bed. She at first hated her, but then she amused herself playing nurse. She was jealous of her brother. She sniggered, made up stories, disobeyed, and threatened to go back to her grandmother's. She often accused her mother of not telling the truth, because she suspected her of lying about the infant's birth. Feeling obscurely that there was a difference between having a child as a nurse and having one as a mother, she asked her mother, "Shall I be a different woman from you?" She got into the habit of yelling for her parents during the night, and as the earthquake of Messina was much talked about, she made it the pretext of her anxieties. She constantly asked questions about it. One day she asked outright, "Why is Sophie younger than I? Where was Freddy before? Was he in heaven? And what was he doing there?" Her mother decided she ought to explain that the little brother grew inside her stomach like plants in the earth. Anna was enchanted with this idea. Then she asked, "But did he come all by himself?" "Yes." "But he can't walk yet." "He crawled out." "Did he come out here?" pointing to her chest. "Or did he come out of your mouth?" Without waiting for an answer, she said she knew it was the stork that had brought it, but in the evening she suddenly said, "My brother is in Italy. He has a house made of cloth and glass, and it doesn't fall down." Note, this was a made-up older brother who played a big role in her games. And she was no longer interested in the earthquake and asked to see photos of the eruption. She spoke again of the stork to her dolls, but without much conviction. Soon, however, she had new curiosities. Seeing her father in bed, "Why are you in bed? Have you got a plant in your inside, too?" She had a dream. She dreamed of Noah's Ark. And underneath there was a lid which opened and all the little animals fell out. In fact, her Noah's Ark opened by the roof. At this time, she again had nightmares. One could guess that she was wondering about the father's role. A pregnant woman having visited her mother, the next day her mother saw Anna put a doll under her skirts and take it out slowly, saying, "Look, the baby is coming out. Now it is all out." Sometime later, eating an orange, she said, "I'll swallow it all down into my stomach, and then I shall get a baby." One morning, her father was in the bathroom. She jumped on his bed, lay flat on her face, and flailed with her legs, crying out, "Look, is that what Papa does?" For 5 months, she seemed to forget her preoccupations, and then she began to mistrust her father. She thought he wanted to drown her, etc. One day, she was happily sowing seeds in the earth with the gardener, and she asked her father, "How do the eyes grow into the head? And the hair?" The father explained that they were already there from the beginning and grew with the head. Then she asked, "But how did Fritz get into Mama? Who stuck him in? And who stuck you into your Mama? Where did he come out?" Her father said, smiling, "What do you think?" So she pointed to his sexual organs. "Did he come out from there?" "Well, yes." "But how did he get into Mama? Did someone sow the seed?" So the father explained that it is the father who gives the seed. She seemed totally satisfied, and the next day she teased her mother. "Papa told me that Fritz was a little angel and was brought down from heaven by the stork." She was much calmer than before. She had, though, a dream in which she saw gardeners urinating, her father among them. She also dreamed, after seeing the gardener plane a drawer, that he was planing her genitals. She was obviously preoccupied with knowing the father's exact role. It seems that, almost completely enlightened at the age of 5, she did not experience any other disturbance. Note, in Jung, Development of Personality, Translation. This story is characteristic, although very often the little girl is less precisely inquisitive about the role played by the father, or the parents are much more evasive on this point. Many little girls hide cushions under their pinafores to play at being pregnant, or else they walk around with their doll in the folds of their skirts and let it fall into the cradle, or they give it their breast. Boys, like girls, admire the mystery of motherhood. All children have an in-depth imagination that makes them sense secret riches inside things. They are all sensitive to the miracle of nesting. Dolls that contain other smaller dolls, boxes containing other boxes, vignettes identically reproduced in reduced form. They are all enchanted when a bud is unfolded before their eyes, when they are shown a chick in its shell, or the surprise of Japanese flowers in a bowl of water. One little boy, upon opening an Easter egg full of little sugar eggs, exclaimed with delight, "Oh, a mummy!" Having a child emerge from a woman's stomach is beautiful, like a magic trick. The mother seems endowed with wonderful fairy powers. Many boys bemoan that such a privilege is denied them. If later they take eggs from nests, stamp on young plants, if they destroy life around them with a kind of rage, it is out of revenge at not being able to hatch life, while the little girl is enchanted with the thought of creating it one day. In addition to this hope made concrete by playing with dolls, a housewife's life also provides the little girl with possibilities of affirming herself. A great part of housework can be accomplished by a very young child. A boy is usually exempted from it, but his sister is allowed, even asked, to sweep, dust, peel vegetables, wash a newborn, watch the stew. In particular, the older sister often participates in maternal chores. Either for convenience or because of hostility and sadism, the mother unloads many of her functions onto her. She is then prematurely integrated into the universe of the Sirius, feeling her importance will help her assume her femininity. But she is deprived of the happy gratuitousness, the carefree childhood, a woman before her time. She understands too soon what limits this specificity imposes on a human being. She enters adolescence as an adult, which gives her story a unique character. The overburdened child can prematurely be a slave, condemned to a joyless existence. But if no more than an effort equal to her is demanded, she experiences the pride of feeling efficient, like a grown person, and is delighted to feel solidarity with adults. This solidarity is possible for the child because there is not much distance between the child and the housewife. A man specialized in his profession is separated from the infant stage by years of training. Paternal activities are profoundly mysterious for the little boy. The man he will be later is barely sketched in him. On the contrary, the mother's activities are accessible to the little girl. She's already a little woman, say her parents, and often she is considered more precocious than the boy. In fact, if she is closer to the adult stage, it is because this stage traditionally remains more infantile for the majority of women. The fact is that she feels precocious. She is flattered to play the role of little mother to the younger ones. She easily becomes important. She speaks reason. She gives orders. She takes on superior airs with her brothers, who are still closed in the baby circle. She talks to her mother on an equal footing. In spite of these compensations, she does not accept her assigned destiny without regret. Growing up, she envies boys their virility. Sometimes parents and grandparents poorly hide the fact that they would have preferred a male offspring to a female, or else they show more affection to the brother than to the sister. Research shows that the majority of parents wish to have sons rather than daughters. Boys are spoken to with more seriousness and more esteem, and more rights are granted them. They themselves treat girls with contempt. They play among themselves and exclude girls from their group. They insult them. They call them names like pisspots, thus evoking girls' secret childhood humiliations. In France, in coeducational schools, the boys' caste deliberately oppresses and persecutes the girls. But girls are reprimanded if they want to compete or fight with them. They doubly envy singularly boyish activities. They have a spontaneous desire to affirm their power over the world, and they protest against the inferior situation they are condemned to. They suffer in being forbidden to climb trees, ladders, and roofs, among other activities. Adler observes that the notions of high and low have great importance, the idea of spatial elevation implying a spiritual superiority, as can be seen in numerous heroic myths. To attain a peak or a summit is to emerge beyond the given world as sovereign subject. Between boys, it is frequently a pretext for challenge. The little girl, to whom exploits are forbidden and who sits under a tree or by a cliff and sees the triumphant boys above her, feels herself, body and soul, inferior. And the same is true if she is left behind in a race or a jumping competition, or if she is thrown to the ground in a fight or simply pushed to the side. The more the child matures, the more his universe expands and masculine superiority asserts itself. Very often, identification with the mother no longer seems a satisfactory solution. If the little girl at first accepts her feminine vocation, it is not that she means to abdicate. On the contrary, it is to rule. She wants to be a matron because matron society seems privileged to her. But when her acquaintances, studies, amusements, and reading material tear her away from the maternal circle, she realizes that it is not women, but men, who are the masters of the world. It is this revelation, far more than the discovery of the penis, that imperiously modifies her consciousness of herself. She first discovers the hierarchy of the sexes in the family experience. Little by little, she understands that the father's authority is not the one felt most in daily life, but it is the sovereign one. It has all the more impact for not being wasted on trifling matters. Even though the mother reigns over the household, she is clever enough to put the father's will first. At important moments, she makes demands, rewards, and punishes in his name. The father's life is surrounded by mysterious prestige. The hours he spends in the home, the room where he works, the objects around him, his occupations, his habits, have a sacred character. It is he who feeds the family, is the one in charge, and the head. Usually he works outside the home, and it is through him that the household communicates with the rest of the world. He is the embodiment of this adventurous, immense, difficult, and marvelous world. He is transcendence. He is God. Note, his generous person inspired in me a great love and an extreme fear, says Madame de Noailles, speaking of her father. First of all, he astounded me. The first man astounds a little girl. I well understood that everything depended on him. This is what the child feels physically in the power of his arms that lift her, in the strength of his body that she huddles against. The mother loses her place of honor to him, just as Isis once did to Ra, and the earth to the sun. But for the child, her situation is deeply altered. She was intended one day to become a woman like her all-powerful mother. She will never be the sovereign father. The bond that attached her to her mother was an active emulation. From her father, she can only passively expect esteem. The boy grasps paternal superiority through a feeling of rivalry, whereas the girl endures it with impotent admiration. I have already stated that what Freud called the Electra complex is not, as he maintains, a sexual desire. It is a deep abdication of the subject who consents to be object in submission and adoration. If the father shows tenderness for his daughter, she feels her existence magnificently justified. She is endowed with all the merits that others have to acquire the hard way. She is fulfilled and deified. It may be that she nostalgically searches for this plenitude and peace her whole life. If she is refused love, she can feel guilty and condemned forever, or else she can seek self-esteem elsewhere and become indifferent, even hostile to her father. Besides, the father is not the only one to hold the keys to the world. All men normally share virile prestige. There is no reason to consider them father substitutes. It is implicitly as men that grandfathers, older brothers, uncles, girlfriends' fathers, friends of the family, professors, priests, or doctors fascinate a little girl. The emotional consideration that adult women show the man would be enough to perch him on a pedestal. Note, it is worth noting that the cult of the father is most prevalent with the oldest child. The man is more involved in his first paternal experience. It is often he who consoles his daughter, as he consoles his son, when the mother is occupied with newborns, and the daughter becomes ardently attached to him. On the contrary, the younger child never has her father to herself. She is ordinarily jealous of both him and her older sister. She attaches herself to that same sister whom the devoted father invests with great prestige. Or she turns to her mother, or she revolts against her family and looks for relief somewhere else. In large families, the youngest girl child finds other ways to have a special place. Of course, many circumstances can motivate the father to have special preferences, but almost all of the cases I know confirm this observation on the contrasting attitudes of the oldest and the youngest sisters. Everything helps to confirm this hierarchy in the little girl's eyes. Her historical and literary culture, the songs and legends she is raised on, are an exaltation of the man. Men made Greece, the Roman Empire, France, and all countries. They discovered the earth and invented the tools to develop it. They governed it, peopled it with statues, paintings, and books. Children's literature, mythology, tales, and stories reflect the myths created by men's pride and desires. The little girl discovers the world and reads her destiny through the eyes of men. Male superiority is overwhelming. Perseus, Hercules, David, Achilles, Lancelot, Duguesclin, Bayard, Napoleon, so many men for one Joan of Arc. And behind her stands the great male figure of Saint Michael, the Archangel. Nothing is more boring than books retracing the lives of famous women. They are very pale figures next to those of the great men. and most are immersed in the shadows of some male hero. Eve was not created for herself, but as Adam's companion, and drawn from his side. In the Bible, few women are noteworthy for their actions. Ruth merely found herself a husband. Esther gained the Jews' grace by kneeling before Ahasuerus, and even then she was only a docile instrument in Mordecai's hands. Judith was bolder, but she too obeyed the priests, and her exploit has a dubious aftertaste. It could not be compared to the pure and shining triumph of young David. Mythology's goddesses are frivolous or capricious, and they all tremble before Jupiter. While Prometheus magnificently steals the fire from the sky, Pandora opens the box of catastrophes. There are a few sorceresses, some old women who wield formidable power in stories. Among them is The Garden of Paradise by Anderson, in which the figure of the Mother of the Winds recalls that of the primitive great goddess. Her four enormous sons fearfully obey her. She beats and encloses them in bags when they behave badly. But they are not attractive characters. More seductive are the fairies, mermaids, and nymphs who escape male domination, but their existence is dubious and barely individualized. They are involved in the human world without having their own destiny. The day Anderson's Little Mermaid becomes a woman, she experiences the yoke of love and suffering that is her lot. In contemporary accounts, as in ancient legends, the man is the privileged hero. Madame de Ségur's books are a curious exception. They describe a matriarchal society where the husband plays a ridiculous character when he is not absent, but usually the image of the father is, as in the real world, surrounded by glory. It is under the aegis of the father, sanctified by his absence, that the feminine dramas of Little Women take place. In adventure stories, it is boys who go around the world, travel as sailors on boats, subsist on breadfruit in the jungle. All important events happen because of men. Reality confirms these novels and legends. If the little girl reads the newspapers, if she listens to adult conversation, she notices that today, as in the past, men lead the world. The heads of state, generals, explorers, musicians, and painters she admires are men. It is men who make her heart beat with enthusiasm. That prestige is reflected in the supernatural world. Generally, as a result of the role religion plays in women's lives, the little girl, more dominated by the mother than the boy, is also more subjected to religious influences. And in Western religions, God the Father is a man, an old man, endowed with a specifically virile attribute, luxuriant white beard. Note: moreover, I was no longer suffering from my inability to see God because I had recently managed to imagine him in the form of my dead grandfather. This image, in truth, was rather human, but I had quickly glorified it by separating my grandfather's head from his bust and mentally putting it on a sky blue background where white clouds made him a collar. Yasu Goclair says in The Blue Orange. For Christians, Christ is even more concretely a man of flesh and blood with a long blonde beard. Angels have no sex, according to theologians, but they have masculine names and are shown as handsome young men. God's emissaries on earth, the Pope, the Bishop, whose ring is kissed, the priest who says Mass, the preacher, the person one kneels before in the secrecy of the confessional, these are men. For a pious little girl, relations with the Eternal Father are analogous to those she maintains with her earthly father. As they take place on an imaginary level, she experiences an even more total surrender. The Catholic religion, among others, exercises on her the most troubling of influences. Note: there is no doubt that women are infinitely more passive, given to man, servile, and humiliated in Catholic countries, Italy, Spain, and France, than in the Protestant, Scandinavian, and Anglo-Saxon ones. And this comes in great part from their own attitude. The cult of the Virgin, confession, and so on invites them to masochism. The virgin welcomes the angel's words on her knees. "I am the handmaiden of the Lord," she answers. Mary Magdalene is prostrate at Christ's feet, and she washes them with her long womanly hair. Women saints declare their love to a radiant Christ on their knees. On his knees, surrounded by the odor of incense, the child gives himself up to God's and the angel's gaze, a man's gaze. There are many analogies between erotic and mystical language as spoken by women. For example, Saint Therese writes of the child Jesus, "O my beloved, by your love I accept not to see on earth the sweetness of your gaze, not to feel the inexpressible kiss from your mouth, but I beg of you to embrace me with your love. My beloved of your first smile, let me soon glimpse the sweetness. Ah, leave me in my burning deliriousness. Yes, let me hide myself in your heart. I want to be mesmerized by your divine gaze. I want to become prey to your love. One day, I have hope, you will melt on me, carrying me to love's hearth. You will put me into this burning chasm to make me become, once and for all, the lucky victim." But it must not be concluded from this that these effusions are always sexual. Rather, when female sexuality develops, it is penetrated with the religious feeling that woman has devoted to man since childhood. It is true that the little girl experiences a thrill in the confessional and even at the foot of the altar, close to what she will later feel in her lover's arms. Woman's love is one of the forms of experience in which a consciousness makes itself an object for a being that transcends it. And these are also the passive delights that the young pious girl tastes in the shadows of the church. Prostrate, her face buried in her hands, she experiences the miracle of renunciation. On her knees, she climbs to heaven. Her abandon in God's arms assures her an assumption lined with clouds and angels. She models her earthly future on this marvelous experience. The child can also discover it in other ways. Everything encourages her to abandon herself in dreams to the arms of men to be transported to a sky of glory. She learns that to be happy, she has to be loved. To be loved, she has to await love. Woman is Sleeping Beauty, Donkey Skin, Cinderella, Snow White, the one who receives and endures. In songs and tales, the young man sets off to seek the woman. He fights against dragons. He combats giants. She is locked up in a tower, a palace, a garden, a cave, chained to a rock, captive, put to sleep. She is waiting. "One day my prince will come. Someday he'll come along, the man I love." The popular refrains breathe dreams of patience and hope in her. The supreme necessity for woman is to charm a masculine heart. This is the recompense all heroines aspire to, even if they are intrepid, adventuresome, and only their beauty is asked of them in most cases. It is thus understandable that attention to her physical appearance can become a real obsession for the little girl. Princesses or shepherds, one must always be pretty to conquer love and happiness. Ugliness is cruelly associated with meanness, and when one sees the misfortunes that befall ugly girls, one does not know if it is their crimes or their disgrace that destiny punishes. Young beauties promised a glorious future often start out in the role of victim. The story of Genevieve de Brabant or of Griselda are not as innocent as it would seem. Love and suffering are intertwined in a troubling way. Woman is assured of the most delicious triumphs when falling to the bottom of abjection. Whether it be a question of God or a man, the little girl learns that by consenting to the most serious renunciations, she will become all-powerful. She takes pleasure in a masochism that promises her supreme conquests. Saint Blondine, white and bloody in the paws of lions, Snow White, lying as if dead in a glass coffin, Sleeping Beauty, Atala fainting, a whole cohort of tender heroines beaten, passive, wounded, on their knees, humiliated, teach their younger sisters the fascinating prestige of martyred, abandoned, and resigned beauty. It is not surprising that while her brother plays at the hero, the little girl plays so easily at the martyr. The pagans throw her to the lions. Bluebeard drags her by her hair. The king, her husband, exiles her to the depths of the forests. She resigns herself, she suffers, she dies, and her brow is haloed with glory. While still a little girl, I wanted to draw men's attention, trouble them, be saved by them, die in their arms. Madame de Noailles writes, a remarkable example of these masochistic musings is found in La Voile Noire, The Black Sail, by Maria Le Ardouin. At 7, from I don't know which rib, I made my first man. He was tall, thin, very young, dressed in a suit of black satin with long sleeves touching the ground. His beautiful blonde hair cascaded in heavy curls onto his shoulders. I called him Edmund. Then a day came when I gave him two brothers. These three brothers, Edmund, Charles, and Cedric, all three dressed in black satin, all three blonde and slim, procured for me strange blessings. Their feet, shod in silk, were so beautiful, and their hands so fragile, that I felt all sorts of movements in my soul. I became their sister, Marguerite. I loved to represent myself as subjected to the whims of my brothers and totally at their mercy. I dreamed that my oldest brother, Edmund, had the right of life and death over me. I never had permission to raise my eyes to his face. He had me whipped under the slightest pretext. When he addressed himself to me, I was so overwhelmed by fear and respect that I found nothing else to answer him and mumbled constantly, "Yes, my lordship. No, my lordship." And I savored the strange delight of feeling like an idiot. When the suffering he imposed on me was too great, I murmured, "Thank you, my lordship." And there came a moment when, almost faltering from suffering, I placed, so as not to shout, my lips on his hand, while, some movement finally breaking my heart, I reached one of these states in which one desires to die from too much happiness. At an early age, the little girl already dreams she has reached the age of love. At 9 or 10, she loves to make herself up. She pads her blouse, she disguises herself as a lady. She does not, however, look for any erotic experience with little boys. If she does go with them into the corner to play doctor, it is only out of sexual curiosity. But the partner of her amorous dreaming is an adult, either purely imaginary or based on real individuals. In the latter case, the child is satisfied to love him from afar. In Colette Audrey's memoirs, there is a very good example of a child's dreaming. She recounts that she discovered love at 5 years of age. Note, aux yeux du souvenir, in the eyes of memory. This naturally had nothing to do with the little sexual pleasures of childhood, the satisfaction I felt, for example, straddling a certain chair in the dining room or caressing myself before falling asleep. The only common characteristic between the feeling and the pleasure is that I carefully hid them both from those around me. My love for this young man consisted in thinking of him before falling asleep and imagining marvelous stories. In Privas, I was in love with all the department heads of my father's office. I was never very deeply hurt by their departure, because they were barely more than a pretext for my amorous musings. In the evening, in bed, I got my revenge for too much youth and shyness. I prepared everything very carefully. I did not have any trouble making him present to me, but it was a question of transforming myself, me, so that I could see myself from the interior, because I became her and stopped being I. First, I was pretty and 18 years old. A tin of sweets helped me a lot, a long tin of rectangular and flat sweets that depicted two girls surrounded by doves. I was the dark, curly-headed one, dressed in a long muslin dress. A 10-year absence had separated us. He returned scarcely aged, and the sight of this marvelous creature overwhelmed him. She seemed to barely remember him. She was unaffected, indifferent, and witty. I composed truly brilliant conversations for this first meeting. They were followed by misunderstandings, a whole difficult conquest, cruel hours of discouragement and jealousy for him. Finally, pushed to the limit, he admitted his love. She listened to him in silence, and just at the moment he thought all was lost, she told him she had never stopped loving him, and they embraced a little. The scene normally took place on a park bench in the evening. I saw the two forms close together. I heard the murmur of voices. I felt at the same time the warm body contact. But then everything came loose. Never did I broach marriage. The next day, I thought of it a little while washing. I don't know why the soapy face I was looking at in the mirror delighted me. The rest of the time, I didn't find myself beautiful, and filled me with hope. I would have considered for hours this misty, tilted face that seemed to be waiting for me from afar on the road to the future. But I had to hurry. Once I dried my face, everything was over, and I got back my banal child's face, which no longer interested me. Note, unlike Le Ardouin's masochistic imagination, Audrey's is sadistic. She wants the beloved to be wounded, in danger, for her to save him heroically, not without humiliating him. This is a personal note, characteristic of a woman who will never accept passivity and will attempt to conquer her autonomy as a human being. Games and dreams orient the girl toward passivity, but she is a human being before becoming a woman, and she already knows that accepting herself as woman means resigning and mutilating herself. While renunciation might be tempting, mutilation is abhorrent. Man and love are still far away in the mist of the future. In the present, the little girl seeks activity, autonomy, like her brothers. The burden of freedom is not heavy for children because it does not involve responsibility. They know they are safe in the shelter of adults. They are not tempted to flee from themselves. The girl's spontaneous zest for life, her taste for games, laughter, and adventure make her consider the maternal circle narrow and stultifying. She wants to escape her mother's authority, an authority that is wielded in a more routine and intimate manner than the one that boys have to accept. Rare are the cases in which she is as understanding and discreet as in this Cido that Colette painted with love. Not to mention the almost pathological cases, there are many, where the mother is a kind of executioner, satisfying her domineering and sadistic instincts on the child. Her daughter is the privileged object opposite whom she attempts to affirm herself as sovereign subject. This attempt makes the child balk in revolt. Note, refer to Vie le Duc, l'asphyxie, in the prison of her skin. S. de Tervagne, la haine maternelle, maternal hatred. H. Bazin, vipère au poing, viper in the fist. Colette Audrey described this rebellion of a normal girl against a normal mother. I wouldn't have known how to answer the truth, however innocent it was, because I never felt innocent in front of Mama. She was the essential adult, and I resented her for as long as I was not yet cured. There was deep inside me a kind of tumultuous and fierce sore that I was sure of always finding raw. I didn't think she was too strict, nor that she hadn't the right. I thought no, 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 with all my strength. I didn't even blame her for her authority or for her orders or arbitrary defenses, but for wanting to subjugate me. She said it sometimes. When she didn't say it, her eyes and voice did. Or else she told ladies that children are much more docile after a punishment. These words stuck in my throat, unforgettable. I couldn't vomit them. I couldn't swallow them. This anger was my guilt in front of her and also my shame in front of me because, in reality, she frightened me. And all I had on my side in the form of retaliation were a few violent words or acts of insolence. But also my glory, nevertheless. As long as the sore was there and living the silent madness that made me only repeat, subjugate, docile, punishment, humiliation, I wouldn't be subjugated. Rebellion is even more violent in the frequent cases when the mother has lost her prestige. She appears as the one who waits, endures, complains, cries, and makes scenes. And in daily reality, this thankless role does not lead to any apotheosis. Victim, she is scorned. Shrew, she is detested. Her destiny appears to be the prototype of bland repetition. With her, life only repeats itself stupidly without going anywhere. Blocked in her housewifely role, she stops the expansion of her existence. She is obstacle and negation. Her daughter wants not to take after her. She dedicates a cult to women who have escaped feminine servitude, actresses, writers, and professors. She gives herself enthusiastically to sports and to studies. She climbs trees, tears her clothes, tries to compete with boys. Very often, she has a best friend in whom she confides. It is an exclusive friendship like a love affair that usually includes sharing sexual secrets. The little girls exchange information they have succeeded in getting and talk about it. Often there is a triangle, one of the girls falling in love with her girlfriend's brother. Thus Sonya in War and Peace is in love with her best friend Natasha's brother. In any case, this friendship is shrouded in mystery, and in general at this period, the child loves to have secrets. She makes a secret of the most insignificant thing. Thus does she react against the secrecies that thwart her curiosity. It is also a way of giving herself importance. She tries by all means to acquire it. She tries to be part of adults' lives. She makes up stories about them that she only half believes and in which she plays a major role. With her friends, she feigns returning boys' scorn with scorn. They form a closed group. They sneer and mock them. But in fact, she is flattered when they treat her as an equal. She seeks their approbation. She would like to belong to the privileged caste. The same movement that in primitive hordes subjects woman to male supremacy is manifested in each new arrival by a refusal of her lot. In her, transcendence condemns the absurdity of imminence. She is annoyed at being oppressed by rules of decency, bothered by her clothes, enslaved to cleaning tasks, held back in all her enthusiasms. On this point, there have been many studies that have almost all given the same result. All the boys, like Plato in the past, say they would have hated to be girls. Almost all the girls are sorry not to be boys. Note, there is an exception. For example, in a Swiss school where boys and girls participating in the same coeducation, in privileged conditions of comfort and freedom, all declared themselves satisfied. But such circumstances are exceptional. Obviously, the girls could be as happy as the boys, but in present society, the fact is that they are not. According to Havelock Ellis's statistics, one boy out of 100 wanted to be a girl. More than 75% of the girls would have preferred to change sex. According to a study by Carl Pipal, cited by Baudouin in his work L'âme enfantine, The Mind of the Child, out of 20 boys of 12 to 14 years of age, 18 said they would rather be anything in the whole world than a girl. Out of 22 girls, 10 wished to be boys and gave the following reasons. Boys are better. They do not have to suffer like women. My mother would love me more. A boy does more interesting work. A boy has more aptitude for school. I would have fun frightening girls. I would not fear boys anymore. They are freer. Boys' games are more fun. They are not held back by their clothes. This last observation is recurrent. Almost all the girls complain of being bothered by their clothes, of not being free in their movements, of having to watch their skirts or light-colored outfits that get dirty so easily. At about 10 or 12 years of age, most little girls are really tomboys, that is, children who lack the license to be boys. Not only do they suffer from it as a privation and an injustice, but the regime they are condemned to is unhealthy. The exuberance of life is prohibited to them. Their stunted vigor turns into nervousness. Their goody-goody occupations do not exhaust their brimming energy. They are bored. Out of boredom and to compensate for the inferiority from which they suffer, they indulge in morose and romantic daydreams. They begin to have a taste for these facile escapes and lose the sense of reality. They succumb to their emotions with a confused exaltation. Since they cannot act, they talk, readily mixing up serious words with totally meaningless ones. Abandoned, misunderstood, they go looking for consolation in narcissistic sentiments. They look on themselves as heroines in novels, admire themselves, and complain. It is natural for them to become keen on their appearance and to play act. These defects will grow during puberty. Their malaise expresses itself in impatience, tantrums, tears. They indulge in tears, an indulgence many women keep later, largely because they love to play the victim. It is both a protest against the harshness of their destiny and a way of endearing themselves to others. Little girls love to cry so much that I have known them to cry in front of a mirror in order to double the pleasure, says Monsignor Dupanloup. Most of their dramas concern relations with their family. They try to break their bonds with their mothers. Either they are hostile to them, or they continue to feel a profound need for protection. They would like to monopolize their father's love for themselves. They are jealous, touchy, demanding. They often make up stories. They imagine they are adopted, that their parents are not really theirs. They attribute a secret life to them. They dream about their sexual relations. They love to imagine that their father is misunderstood, unhappy, that he is not finding in his wife the ideal companion that his daughter would be for him, or, on the contrary, that the mother rightly finds him rough and brutal, that she is appalled by any physical relations with him. Fantasies, acting out, childish tragedies, false enthusiasms, strange things. The reason must be sought not in a mysterious feminine soul, but in the child's situation. It is a strange experience for an individual recognizing himself as subject, autonomy, and transcendence, as an absolute, to discover inferiority as a given essence in his self. It is a strange experience for one who posits himself for himself as one to be revealed to himself as alterity. That is what happens to the little girl when, learning about the world, she grasps herself as a woman in it. The sphere she belongs to is closed everywhere, limited, dominated by the male universe. As high as she climbs, as far as she dares go, there will always be a ceiling over her head, walls that block her path. Man's gods are in such a faraway heaven that in truth, for him, there are no gods. The little girl lives among gods with a human face. This is not a unique situation. American blacks, partially integrated into a civilization that nevertheless considers them an inferior caste, live it. What Bigger Thomas experiences with so much bitterness at the dawn of his life is this definitive inferiority. This cursed alterity inscribed in the color of his skin. He watches planes pass, and knows that because he is black, the sky is out of bounds for him. Note, Richard Wright, Native Son. Because she is woman, the girl knows that the sea and the poles, 1,000 adventures, 1,000 joys are forbidden to her. She is born on the wrong side. The great difference is that the blacks endure their lot in revolt. No privilege compensates for its severity, while for the woman, her complicity is invited. Earlier, I recalled that in addition to the authentic claim of the subject who claims sovereign freedom, there is an inauthentic desire for renunciation and escape in the existent. Note, refer to introduction to Volume 1. These are the delights of passivity that parents and educators, books and myths, women and men dangle before the little girl's eyes. In early childhood, she is already taught to taste them. Temptation becomes more and more insidious, and she yields to it even more fatally as the thrust of her transcendence comes up against harsher and harsher resistance. But in accepting her passivity, she also accepts without resistance enduring a destiny that is going to be imposed on her from the exterior, and this fatality frightens her. Whether ambitious, scatterbrained, or shy, the young boy leaps toward an open future. He will be a sailor or an engineer. He will stay in the fields or will leave for the city. He will see the world. He will become rich. He feels free faced with a future where unexpected opportunities await him. The girl will be wife, mother, grandmother. She will take care of her house exactly as her mother does. She will take care of her children as she was taken care of. She is 12 years old, and her story is already written in the heavens. She will discover it day after day without shaping it. She is curious but frightened when she thinks about this life, whose every step is planned in advance, and toward which each day irrevocably moves her. This is why the little girl, even more so than her brothers, is preoccupied with sexual mysteries. Of course, boys are interested as well, just as passionately. But in their future, their role of husband and father is not what concerns them the most. Marriage and motherhood put in question the little girl's whole destiny, and as soon as she begins to perceive their secrets, her body seems odiously threatened to her. The magic of motherhood has faded. Whether she has been informed early or not, she knows, in a more or less coherent manner, that a baby does not appear by chance in the mother's belly and does not come out at the wave of a magic wand. She questions herself anxiously. Often it seems not extraordinary at all, but rather horrible that a parasitic body should proliferate inside her body. The idea of this monstrous swelling frightens her. And how will the baby get out? Even if she was never told about the cries and suffering of childbirth, she has overheard things. She has read the words in the Bible. In sorrow, thou shalt bring forth children. She has the presentiment of tortures she cannot even imagine. She invents strange operations around her navel. She is no less reassured if she supposes that the fetus will be expelled by her anus. Little girls have been seen to have nervous constipation attacks when they thought they had discovered the birthing process. Accurate explanations will not bring much relief. Images of swelling, tearing, and hemorrhaging will haunt her. The more imaginative she is, the more sensitive the little girl will be to these visions. But no girl could look at them without shuddering. Colette relates how her mother found her in a faint after reading Zola's description of a birth. The author depicted the birth with a rough-and-ready crude wealth of detail, an anatomical precision, and a lingering over colors, postures, and cries, in which I recognized none of the tranquil, knowing experience on which I, as a country girl, could draw. I felt credulous, startled and vulnerable in my nascent femininity. Other words, right in front of my eyes, depicted flesh splitting open, excrement and sullied blood. The lawn rose to welcome me, like one of those little hares that poachers sometimes brought, freshly killed, into the kitchen. Note, Claudine's House, translation. The reassurance offered by grown-ups leaves the child worried. Growing up, she learns not to trust the word of adults. Often, it is on the very mysteries of her conception that she has caught them in lies. And she also knows that they consider the most frightening things normal. If she has ever experienced a violent physical shock, tonsils removed, tooth pulled, Whitlow lanced, she will project the remembered anxiety onto childbirth. The physical nature of pregnancy and childbirth suggests as well that something physical takes place between the spouses. The often encountered word blood in expressions like same blood children, pure blood, and mixed blood sometimes orients the childish imagination. It is supposed that marriage is accompanied by some solemn transfusion, but more often the physical thing seems to be linked to the urinary and excremental systems. In particular, children think that the man urinates into the woman. This sexual operation is thought of as dirty. This is what overwhelms the child for whom dirty things have been rife with the strictest taboos. How, then, can it be that they are integrated into adults' lives? The child is first of all protected from scandal by the very absurdity he discovers. He finds there is no sense to what he hears around him, what he reads, what he writes. Everything seems unreal to him. In Carson McCullers's charming book, The Member of the Wedding, the young heroine surprises two neighbors in bed, nude. The very anomaly of the story keeps her from giving it too much importance. It was a summer Sunday, and the hall door of the Marlowe's room was open. She could see only a portion of the room, part of the dresser, and only the footpiece of the bed with Mrs. Marlowe's corset on it. But there was a sound in the quiet room she could not place, and when she stepped over the threshold, she was startled by a sight that, after a single glance, sent her running to the kitchen, crying, "Mr. Marlowe is having a fit!" Berenice had hurried through the hall, but when she looked into the front room, she merely bunched her lips and banged the door. Frankie had tried to question Berenice and find out what was the matter, but Berenice had only said that they were common people, and added that with a certain party in the house, they ought at least to know enough to shut a door. Though Frankie knew she was the certain party, still she did not understand. "What kind of a fit was it?" she asked, but Berenice would only answer, "Baby, just a common fit," and Frankie knew from the voice's tones that there was more to it than she was told. Later, she only remembered the Marlowes as common people. When children are warned against strangers, when a sexual incident is described to them, it is often explained in terms of sickness, maniacs, or madmen. It is a convenient explanation. The little girl fondled by her neighbor at the cinema, or the girl who sees a man expose himself, thinks that she is dealing with a crazy man. Of course, encountering madness is unpleasant. An epileptic attack, hysteria, or a violent quarrel upsets the adult world order, and the child who witnesses it feels in danger. But after all, just as there are homeless, beggars, and injured people with hideous sores in harmonious society, there can also be some abnormal ones without its base disintegrating. It is when parents, friends, and teachers are suspected of celebrating black masses that the child really becomes afraid. When I was first told about sexual relations between man and woman, I declared that such things were impossible since my parents would have had to do likewise, and I thought too highly of them to believe it. I said that it was much too disgusting for me ever to do it. Unfortunately, I was to be disabused shortly after when I heard what my parents were doing. That was a fearful moment. I hid my face under the bedcovers, stopped my ears, and wished I were 1,000 miles from there. Note, cited by Dr. W. Liepman, Youth and Sexuality. How to go from the image of dressed and dignified people, these people who teach decency, reserve, and reason, to that of naked beasts confronting each other. Here is a contradiction that shakes their pedestal, darkens the sky. Often the child stubbornly refuses the odious revelation. "My parents don't do that," he declares, or he tries to give coitus a decent image. "When you want a child," said a little girl, "you go to the doctor. You undress, you cover your eyes, because you mustn't watch. The doctor ties the parents together and helps them so that it works right." She had changed the act of love into a surgical operation, rather unpleasant at that, but as honorable as going to the dentist. But despite denial and escape, embarrassment and doubt creep into the child's heart. A phenomenon as painful as weaning occurs. It is no longer separating the child from the maternal flesh, but the protective universe that surrounds him falls apart. He finds himself without a roof over his head, abandoned, absolutely alone before a future as dark as night. What adds to the little girl's anxiety is that she cannot discern the exact shape of the equivocal curse that weighs on her. The information she gets is inconsistent. Books are contradictory. Even technical explanations do not dissipate the heavy shadow. 100 questions arise. Is the sexual act painful or delicious? How long does it last? 5 minutes or all night? Sometimes you read that a woman became a mother with one embrace, and sometimes you remain sterile after hours of sexual activity. Do people do that every day or rarely? The child tries to learn more by reading the Bible, consulting dictionaries, asking friends, and he gropes in darkness and disgust. An interesting document on this point is the study made by Dr. Liepman. Here are a few responses given to him by young girls about their sexual initiation. "I continued to stray among my nebulous and twisted ideas. No one broached the subject, neither my mother nor my school teacher. No book treated the subject fully. Little by little, a sort of perilous and ugly mystery was woven around the act, which at first had seemed so natural to me. The older girls of 12 used crude jokes to bridge the gap between themselves and our classmates. All that was still so vague and disgusting. We argued about where the baby was formed, if perhaps the thing only took place once for the man, since marriage was the occasion for so much fuss. My period at 15 was another new surprise. It was my turn to be caught up, in a way, in the round. Sexual initiation, an expression never to be mentioned in our parents' house. I searched in books, but I agonized and wore myself out looking for the road to follow. I went to a boys' school. For my school teacher, the question did not even seem to exist. Horlam's work, Little Boy and Little Girl, finally brought me the truth. My tense state and unbearable overexcitement disappeared. Although I was very unhappy and took a long time to recognize and understand that eroticism and sexuality alone constitute real love. Stages of my initiation. 1. First questions and a few vague notions, totally unsatisfactory. From 3.5 to 11 years old. No answers to the questions I had in the following years. When I was 7, right there, feeding my rabbit, I suddenly saw little naked ones underneath her. My mother told me that in animals and people, little ones grow in their mother's belly and come out through the loins. This birth through the loins seemed unreasonable to me. A nursemaid told me about pregnancy, birth, and menstruation. Finally, my father replied to my last question about his true function with obscure stories about pollen and pistol. 2. Some attempts at personal experimentation, 11 to 13 years old. I dug out an encyclopedia and a medical book. It was only theoretical information in strange, gigantic words. 3. Testing of acquired knowledge, 13 to 20. A. In daily life, B. In scientific works. At 8, I often played with a boy my age. One day we broached the subject. I already knew, because my mother had already told me, that a woman has many eggs inside her, and that a child was born from one of these eggs whenever the mother strongly desired it. Giving this same answer to my friend, I received this reply. You are completely stupid. When our butcher and his wife want a baby, they go to bed and do dirty things.